16. Detta watched all of this from her hiding place with hungrily gleaming eyes. 17.
"Remember, Eddie," he said in a hoarse voice, and then stepped forward.
His body collapsed at the edge of the doorway as if it had struck a stone wall instead of empty space. Eddie felt an almost insatiable urge to go to the doorway, to look through and see where and to what when it led. Instead, he turned and scanned the hills again, his hand on the gun butt.
"I'm going to tell you one last time."
Suddenly, scanning the empty brown hills, Eddie was scared.
"Be on your guard."
Nothing up there was moving. Nothing he could see, at least. He sensed her, all the same. Not Odetta. The gunslinger was right about that. It was Detta he sensed. He swallowed and heard a click in his throat.
"On your guard."
Yes, but never in his life had he felt such a deadly need for sleep. It would take him soon enough. If he didn't give in willingly, sleep would rape him. And while he slept, Detta would come. Detta. Eddie fought the weariness, looked at the unmoving hills with eyes which felt swollen and heavy, and wondered how long it might be before Roland came back with the third, the pusher, whoever he or she was. "Odetta," he called without much hope. Only silence answered, and for Eddie the time of waiting began. The Pusher. Chapter 1. Bitter Medicine. 1. When the gunslinger entered Eddie had experienced a moment of nausea, and he had a sense of being watched. This Roland hadn't felt, Eddie had told him later. He'd had, in other words, some vague sense of the gunslinger's presence. With Detta, Roland had been forced to come forward immediately, like it or not. She hadn't just sensed him. In a queer way, it seemed that she had been waiting for him. Him or another more frequent visitor. Either way, she had been totally aware of his presence from the first moment he had been in her. Jack Mort didn't feel a thing. He was too intent on the boy. He had been watching the boy for the last 2 weeks. Today, he was going to push him. 2. Even with the back to the eyes from which the gunslinger now looked, Roland recognized the boy. It was the boy he had met at the way station in the desert, the boy he had rescued from the Oracle in the mountains, the boy whose life he had sacrificed when the choice between saving him or finally catching up with the man in black finally came, the boy who had said, "Go then, there are other worlds than these," before plunging into the abyss. And sure enough, the boy had been right. The boy was Jake. He was holding a plain brown paper bag in one hand and a blue canvas bag by its drawstring top in the other. From the angles poking against the sides of the canvas, the gunslinger thought it must contain books. Traffic flooded the street the boy was waiting to cross, a street in the same city from which he had taken the prisoner and the lady, he realized. But for the moment, none of that mattered. Nothing mattered but what was going to happen or not happen in the next few seconds. Jake had not been brought into the gunslinger's world through any magic door. He had come through a cruder, more understandable portal. He had been born into Roland's world by dying in his own. He had been murdered. More specifically, he had been pushed. Pushed into the street, run over by a car while on his way to school, his lunch sack in one hand and his books in the other. Pushed by the man in black.
"He's going to do it. He's going to do it right now. That's to be my punishment for murdering him in my world, to see him murdered in this one before I can stop it."
But the rejection of brutish destiny had been the gunslinger's work all his life. It had been his ka, if you pleased. And so he came forward, without even thinking, acting with reflexes so deep they had nearly become instincts. And as he did, a thought both horrible and ironic flashed into his mind. What if the body he had entered was itself that of the man in black? What if, as he rushed forward to save the boy, he saw his own hands reach out and push? What if this sense of control was only an illusion, and Walter's final gleeful joke that Roland himself should murder the boy? 3. For one single moment, Jack Mort lost the thin, strong arrow of his concentration. On the edge of leaping forward and shoving the kid into the traffic, he felt something which his mind mistranslated, just as the body may refer pain from one part of itself to another. When the gunslinger came forward, Jack thought some sort of bug had landed on the back of his neck. Not a wasp or a bee, nothing that actually stung, but something that bit and itched. Mosquito, maybe. It was on this that he blamed his lapse in concentration at the crucial moment. He slapped at it and returned to the boy. He thought all this happened in a bare wink. Actually, 7 seconds passed. He sensed neither the gunslinger's swift advance nor his equally swift retreat. And none of the people around him, going-to-work people, most from the subway station on the next block, their faces still puffy with sleep, their half-dreaming eyes turned inward, noticed Jack's eyes turn from their usual deep blue to a lighter blue behind the prim, gold-rimmed glasses he wore. No one noticed those eyes darken to their normal cobalt color either, but when it happened and he refocused on the boy, he saw with frustrated fury as sharp as a thorn that his chance was gone. The light had changed. He watched the boy crossing with the rest of the sheep, and then Jack turned himself back the way he had come and began shoving himself upstream against the tidal flow of pedestrians. "Hey, mister, watch out!" some curd-faced teenaged girl he barely saw. Jack shoved her aside, hard, not looking back at her caw of anger as her own armload of schoolbooks went flying. He went walking on down Fifth Avenue and away from 43rd, where he had meant for the boy to die today. His head was bent, his lips pressed together so tightly he seemed to have no mouth at all, but only the scar of a long-healed wound above his chin. Once clear of the bottleneck at the corner, he did not slow down, but strode even more rapidly along, crossing 42nd, 41st, 40th. Somewhere in the middle of the next block, he passed the building where the boy lived. He gave it barely a glance, although he had followed the boy from it every school morning for the last 3 weeks, followed him from the building to the corner 3.5 blocks further up Fifth, the corner he thought of simply as the pushing place. The girl he bumped was screaming after him, but Jack Mort didn't notice. An amateur lepidopterist would have taken no more notice of a common butterfly. Jack was, in his way, much like an amateur lepidopterist. By profession, he was a successful CPA. Pushing was only his hobby. 4. The gunslinger returned to the back of the man's mind and fainted there. If there was relief, it was simply that this man was not the man in black, was not Walter. All the rest was utter horror and utter realization. Divorced of his body, his mind, his ka, was as healthy and acute as ever. But the sudden knowing struck him like a chisel blow to the temple. The knowing didn't come when he went forward, but when he was sure the boy was safe and slipped back again. He saw the connection between this man and Odetta, too fantastic and yet too hideously apt to be coincidental, and understood what the real drawing of the three might be, and who they might be. The third was not this man, this pusher. The third named by Walter had been Death. Death, but not for you. That was what Walter, clever as Satan, even at the end had said. A lawyer's answer, so close to the truth that the truth was able to hide in its shadow. Death was not for him. Death was become him. the prisoner, the lady. Death was the third. He was suddenly filled with the certainty that he himself was the third. Five. Roland came forward as nothing but a projectile, a brainless missile programmed to launch the body he was in at the man in black the instant he saw him. Thoughts of what might happen if he stopped the man in black from murdering Jake did not come until later. The possible paradox, the fistula in time and dimension, which might cancel out everything that had happened after he had arrived at the way station. For surely if he saved Jake in this world, there would have been no Jake for him to meet there, and everything which had happened thereafter would change. What changes? Impossible even to speculate on them. That one might have been the end of his quest never entered the gunslinger's mind. And surely such after-the-fact speculations were moot. If he had seen the man in black, no consequence, paradox, or ordained course of destiny could have stopped him from simply lowering the head of this body he inhabited and pounding it straight through Walter's chest. Roland would have been as helpless to do otherwise as a gun is helpless to refuse the finger that squeezes the trigger and flings the bullet on its flight. If it sent all to hell, the hell with it. He scanned the people clustered on the corner quickly, seeing each face. He scanned the women as closely as the men, making sure there wasn't one only pretending to be a woman. Walter wasn't there. Gradually he relaxed, as a finger curled around a trigger may relax at the last instant. No, Walter was nowhere around the boy. And the gunslinger somehow felt sure that this wasn't the right when. Not quite. That when was close, 2 weeks away, a week, maybe even a single day. But it was not quite yet. So, he went back. On the way, he saw... 6. And fell senseless with shock. This man, into whose mind the third door opened, had once sat waiting just inside the window of a deserted tenement room in a building full of abandoned rooms. Abandoned, that was, except for the winos and crazies who often spent their nights here. He knew about the winos because you could smell their desperate sweat and angry piss. You knew about the crazies because you could smell the stink of their deranged thoughts. The only furniture in this room was two chairs. Jack Mort was using both, one to sit in, one as a prop to keep the door opening on the hallway closed. He expected no sudden interruptions, but it was best not to take chances. He was close enough to the window to look out, but far enough behind the slanted shadow line to be safe from any casual viewer. He had a crumbly red brick in his hand. He had pried it from just outside the window, where a good many were loose. It was old, eroded at the corners, but heavy. Chunks of ancient mortar clung to it like barnacles. The man meant to drop the brick on someone. He didn't care who. When it came to murder, Jack Mort was an equal opportunity employer. After a bit, a family of three came along the sidewalk below. Man, woman, little girl. The girl had been walking on the inside, presumably to keep her safely away from the traffic. There was quite a lot of it this close to the railway station, but Jack Mort didn't care about the auto traffic. What he cared about was the lack of buildings directly opposite him. These had already been demolished, leaving a jumbled wasteland of splintered board, broken brick, glinting glass. He would only lean out for a few seconds, and he was wearing sunglasses over his eyes and an out-of-season knit cap over his blonde hair. It was like the chair under the doorknob. Even when you were safe from expected risks, there was no harm in reducing those unexpected ones which remained. He was also wearing a sweatshirt much too big for him, one that came almost down to mid-thigh. This bag of a garment would help confuse the actual size and shape of his body. He was quite thin, should he be observed. It served another purpose as well. Whenever he depth-charged someone, for that was how he always thought of it, as depth-charging, he came in his pants. The baggy sweatshirt also covered the wet spot which invariably formed on his jeans. Now they were closer. "Don't jump the gun. Wait, just wait." He shivered at the edge of the window, brought the brick forward, drew it back to his stomach, brought it forward again, withdrew it again, but this time only halfway, and then leaned out, totally cool now. He always was at the penultimate moment. He dropped the brick and watched it fall. It went down, swapping one end for the other. Jack saw the clinging barnacles of mortar clearly in the sun. At these moments, as at no others, everything was clear. Everything stood out with exact and geometrically perfect substance. Here was a thing which he had pushed into reality, as a sculptor swings a hammer against a chisel to change stone and create some new substance from the brute caldera. Here was the world's most remarkable thing, logic, which was also ecstasy. Sometimes he missed or struck a slant, as the sculptor may carve badly or in vain. But this was a perfect shot. The brick struck the girl in the bright gingham dress squarely on the head. He saw blood, it was brighter than the brick, but would eventually dry to the same maroon color, splash up. He heard the start of the mother's scream. Then he was moving. Jack crossed the room and threw the chair, which had been under the knob, into a far corner. He'd kicked the other, the one he'd sat in while waiting, aside as he crossed the room. He yanked up the sweatshirt and pulled a bandana from his back pocket. He used it to turn the knob. No fingerprints allowed, only Dunk Bee's left fingerprints. He stuffed the bandana into his back pocket again, even as the door was swinging open. As he walked down the hall, he assumed a faintly drunken gait. He didn't look around. Looking around was also only for Don't Bees. Doobies knew that trying to see if someone was noticing you was a sure way to accomplish just that. Looking around was the sort of thing a witness might remember after an accident. Then some smart-ass cop might decide it was a suspicious accident and there would be an investigation, all because of one nervous glance around. Jack didn't believe anyone could connect him with the crime, even if someone decided the accident was suspicious and there was an investigation, but take only acceptable risks. Minimize those which remain. In other words, always prop a chair under the doorknob. So he walked down the powdery corridor where patches of lathing showed through the plastered walls. He walked with his head down, mumbling to himself like the vags you saw on the street. He could still hear the woman, the mother of the little girl, he supposed, screaming, but that sound was coming from the front of the building. It was faint and unimportant. All of the things which happened after, the cries, the confusion, the wails of the wounded, if the wounded were still capable of wailing, were not things which mattered to Jack. What mattered was the thing which pushed change into the ordinary course of things and sculpted new lines in the flow of lives. And perhaps the destinies not only of those struck, but of a widening circle around them, like ripples from a stone tossed into a still pond. Who was to say that he had not sculpted the cosmos today, or might not at some future time? God! No wonder he creamed his jeans. He met no one as he went down the two flights of stairs, but he kept up the act, swaying a little as he went, but never reeling. A swayer would not be remembered. An ostentatious reeler might be. He muttered, but didn't actually say anything a person might understand. Not acting at all would be better than hamming it up. He let himself out the broken rear door into an alley filled with refuse and broken bottles, which twinkled galaxies of sun stars. He had planned his escape in advance, as he planned everything in advance, take only acceptable risks, minimize those which remain, be a doobie in all things. Such planning was why he had been marked by his colleagues as a man who would go far, and he did intend to go far, but one of the places he did not intend to go was to jail or the electric chair. A few people were running along the street into which the alley debouched, but they were on their way to see what the screaming was about, and none of them looked at Jack Mort, who had removed the out-of-season knit cap, but not the sunglasses, which on such a bright morning did not seem out of place. He turned into another alley, came out on another street. Now he sauntered down an alley not so filthy as the first two, almost, in fact, a lane. This fed into another street, and a block up there was a bus stop. Less than a minute after he got there, a bus arrived, which was also a part of the schedule. Jack entered when the doors accordioned open and dropped his 15 cents into the slot of the coin receptacle. The driver did not so much as glance at him. That was good, but even if he had, he would have seen nothing but a nondescript man in jeans, a man who might be out of work. The sweatshirt he was wearing looked like something out of a Salvation Army grab bag. Be ready. Be prepared. Be a doobie. Jack Mort's secret for success, both at work and at play. 9 blocks away, there was a parking lot. Jack got off the bus, entered the lot, unlocked his car, an unremarkable mid-50 Chevrolet, which was still in fine shape, and drove back to New York City. He was free and clear. 7. The gunslinger saw all of this in a mere moment. Before his shocked mind could shut out the other images by simply shutting down, he saw more. Not all, but enough. Enough. 8. He saw Mort cutting a piece from page 4 of the New York Daily Mirror with an X-Acto knife, being fussily sure to stay exactly upon the lines of the column. "Negro girl comatose following tragic accident," the headline read. He saw Mort apply glue to the back of the clipping with the brush attached to the cover of his paste pot. Saw Mort position it at the center of a blank page of a scrapbook, which from the bumpy, swelled look of the foregoing pages contained many other clippings. He saw the opening lines of the piece. 5-year-old Odetta Holmes, who came to Elizabethtown, New Jersey to celebrate a joyous occasion, is now the victim of a cruel freak accident. Following the wedding of an aunt 2 days ago, the girl and her family were walking toward the railway station when a brick tumbled. But that wasn't the only time he'd had dealings with her, was it? No. God's no. In the years between that morning and the night when Odetta had lost her legs, Jack Mort had dropped a great many things and pushed a great many people. Then there had been Odetta again. The first time he had pushed something on her, the second time he had pushed her in front of something. What sort of man is this that I am supposed to use? What sort of man? But then he thought of Jake. Thought of the push which had sent Jake into this world, and he thought he heard the laughter of the man in black, and that finished him. Roland fainted. 9. When he came to, he was looking at neat rows of figures marching down a sheet of green paper. The paper had been ruled both ways so that each single figure looked like a prisoner in a cell. He thought, something else. Not just Walter's laughter, something. A plan? No. Gods, no. Nothing as complex or hopeful as that. But an idea, at least. A tickle. How long have I been out? He thought with sudden alarm. It was maybe 9 o'clock when I came through the door, maybe a little earlier. How long? He came forward. Jack Mort, who was now only a human doll controlled by the gunslinger, looked up a little and saw the hands of the expensive quartz clock on his desk stood at 1:15. Gods, as late as that. As late as that. But Eddie, he was so tired, he could never have stayed awake for so long. The gunslinger turned Jack's head. The door was still there, but what he saw through it was far worse than he would have imagined. Standing to one side of the door were 2 shadows, one that of the wheelchair, the other that of a human being. But the human being was incomplete, supporting itself on its arms because its lower legs had been snatched away with the same quick brutality as Roland's fingers and toe. The shadow moved. Roland whipped Jack Mort's head away at once, moving with the whiplash speed of a striking snake. She mustn't look in, not until I am ready. Until then, she sees nothing but the back of this man's head. Detta Walker would not see Jack Mort in any case, because the person who looked through the open door saw only what the host saw. She could only see Mort's face if he looked into a mirror, although that might lead to its own awful consequences of paradox and repetition, but even then it would mean nothing to either lady. For that matter, the lady's face would not mean anything to Jack Mort. Although they had twice been on terms of deadly intimacy, they had never seen each other. What the gunslinger didn't want was for the lady to see the lady. Not yet, at least. The spark of intuition grew closer to a plan. But it was late over there. The light had suggested to him that it must be 3 in the afternoon, perhaps even 4. How long until sunset brought the lobstrosities and the end of Eddie's life? 3 hours? 2? He could go back and try to save Eddie, but that was exactly what Detta wanted. She had laid a trap, just as villagers who fear a deadly wolf may stake out a sacrificial lamb to draw it into bowshot. He would go back into his diseased body, but not for long. The reason he had seen only her shadow was because she was lying beside the door with one of his revolvers curled in her fist. The moment his Roland body moved, she would shoot it and end his life. His ending, because she feared him, would at least be merciful. Eddie's would be a screaming horror. He seemed to hear Detta Walker's nasty, giggling voice.
"You won't go at me, Grey Meat? Show you won't go at me? You ain't afraid no little old crippled black woman, are you?"
"Only one way," Jack's mouth muttered. "Only one."
The door of the office opened, and a bald man with lenses over his eyes looked in.
"How are you doing on that Dorfman account?" the bald man asked.
"I feel ill. I think it was my lunch. I think I might leave."
The bald man looked worried.
"It's probably a bug. I heard there's a nasty one going around."
"Probably."
"Well, as long as you get the Dorfman stuff finished by 5 tomorrow afternoon."
"Yes."
"Because you know what a dong he can be."
"Yes."
The bald man, now looking a little uneasy, nodded.
"Yes, go home. You don't seem like your usual self at all."
"I'm not."
The bald man went out the door in a hurry. He sensed me, the gunslinger thought. That was part of it. Part, but not all. They're afraid of him. They don't know why, but they're afraid of him. And they're right to be afraid. Jack Mort's body got up, found the briefcase the man had been carrying when the gunslinger entered him, and swept all the papers on the surface of the desk into it. He felt an urge to sneak a look back at the door and resisted it. He would not look again until he was ready to risk everything and come back. In the meantime, time was short and there were things which had to be done. Chapter 2. The Honeypot. 1. Detta laid up in a deeply shadowed cleft formed by rocks which leaned together like old men who had been turned to stone while sharing some weird secret. She watched Eddie range up and down the rubble-strewn slopes of the hills, yelling himself hoarse. The duck fuzz on his cheeks was finally becoming a beard, and you might have taken him for a growed man, except for the 3 or 4 times he passed close to her, once he'd come close enough for her to have snaked a hand out and grabbed his ankle. When he got close, you saw he wasn't nothing but a kid still, and one who was dog-tired to boot. Odetta would have felt pity. Detta felt only the still, coiled readiness of the natural predator. When she first crawled in here, she had felt things crackling under her hands like old autumn leaves in a woods holler. As her eyes adjusted, she saw they weren't leaves, but the tiny bones of small animals. Some predator, long gone, if these ancient yellow bones told the truth, had once denned here, something like a weasel or a ferret. It had perhaps gone out at night, following its nose further up into the drawers to where the trees and undergrowth were thicker, following its nose to prey. It had killed, eaten, and brought the remains back here to snack on the following day as it laid up, waiting for night to bring the time of hunting on again. Now there was a bigger predator here, and at first Detta thought she'd do pretty much what the previous tenant had done. Wait until Eddie fell asleep, as he was almost certain to do, then kill him and drag his body up here. Then, with both guns in her possession, she could drag herself back down by the doorway and wait for the really bad man to come back. Her first thought had been to kill the really bad man's body as soon as she'd taken care of Eddie, but that was no good, was it? If the really bad man had no body to come back to, there would be no way Detta could get out of here and back to her own world. Could she make that really bad man take her back? Maybe not. But maybe so. If he knew Eddie was still alive, maybe so. And that led to a much better idea. 2. She was deeply sly. She would have laughed harshly at anyone daring to suggest it, but she was also deeply insecure. Because of the latter, she attributed the former to anyone she met whose intellect seemed to approach her own. This was how she felt about the gunslinger. She'd heard a shot, and when she looked, she'd seen smoke drifting from the muzzle of his remaining gun. He had reloaded and tossed this gun to Eddie just before going through the door. She knew what it was supposed to mean to Eddie. All the shells weren't wet, after all. The gun would protect him. She also knew what it was supposed to mean to her, for of course the really bad man had known she was watching. Even if she'd been sleeping when the two of them started chinning, the shot would have awakened her. Stay away from him. He's packing iron. But devils could be subtle. If that little show had been put on for her benefit, might not that really bad man have had another purpose in mind as well, one neither she nor Eddie was supposed to see? Might that really bad man not have been thinking, if she sees this one fires good shells, why, she'll think the one she took from Eddie does, too. But suppose he had guessed that Eddie would doze off. Wouldn't he know she would be waiting for just that, waiting to filch the gun and creep slowly away up the slopes to safety? Yes, that really bad man might have foreseen all that. He was smart for a honky, smart enough anyway to see that Detta was bound to get the best of that little white boy. So just maybe that really bad man had purposely loaded this gun with bad shells. He had fooled her once, why not again? This time she'd been careful to check that the chambers were loaded with more than empty casings, and yes, they appeared to be real bullets, but that didn't mean they were. He didn't even have to take the chance that one of them might be dry enough to fire, now did he? He could have fixed them somehow. After all, guns were the really bad man's business. Why would he do that? Why, to trick her into showing herself, of course. Then Eddie could cover her with the gun that really did work, and he would not make the same mistake twice, tired or not. He would, in fact, be especially careful not to make the same mistake twice because he was tired. Nice try, honky, Detta thought in her shadowy den, this tight but somehow comforting dark place whose floor was carpeted with the softened and decaying bones of small animals. Nice try. But I ain't going for that shit. She didn't need to shoot Eddie after all. She only needed to wait. 3. Her one fear was that the gunslinger would return before Eddie fell asleep, but he was still gone. The limp body at the base of the door did not stir. Maybe he was having some kind of trouble getting the medicine he needed. Some other kind of trouble, for all she knew. Men like him seem to find trouble easy as a bitch in heat finds a randy hound. 2 hours passed while Eddie hunted for the woman he called Odetta. Oh, how she hated the sound of that name, ranging up and down the low hills and yelling until he had no voice left to yell with. At last Eddie did what she'd been waiting for. He went back down to the little angle of beach and sat by the wheelchair, looking around disconsolately. He touched one of the chair's wheels, and the touch was almost a caress. Then his hand dropped away, and he fetched him a deep sigh. This sight brought a steely ache to Detta's throat. Pain bolted across her head from one side to the other like summer lightning, and she seemed to hear a voice calling. Calling or demanding. No, you don't, she thought, having no idea who she was thinking about or speaking to. No, you don't, not this time, not now. Not now. Maybe not ever again. That bolt of pain ripped through her head again, and she curled her hands into fists. Her face made its own fist, twisting itself into a sneer of concentration, an expression remarkable and arresting in its mixture of ugliness and almost beatific determination. That bolt of pain did not come again. Neither did the voice, which sometimes seemed to speak through such pains. She waited. Eddie propped his chin on his fists, propping his head up. Soon it began to droop anyway, the fist sliding up his cheeks. Detta waited, black eyes gleaming. Eddie's head jerked up. He struggled to his feet, walked down to the water, and splashed his face with it. That's right, white boy. Crying shame there ain't any no-dos in this world, or you be taking that too, ain't that right? Eddie sat down in the wheelchair this time, but evidently found that just a little too comfortable. So after a long look through the open door, "What you seeing in there, white boy? Daddy give a $20 bill to know dat." He plopped his ass down on the sand again, propped his head with his hands again. Soon his head began to slip down again. This time there was no stopping it. His chin lay on his chest, and even over the surf she could hear him snoring. Pretty soon he fell over on his side and curled up. She was surprised, disgusted, and frightened to feel a sudden stab of pity for the white boy down there. He looked like nothing so much as a little squirt who had tried to stay up until midnight on New Year's Eve and lost the race. Then she remembered the way he and the really bad man had tried to get her to eat poison food and teased her with their own, always snatching away at the last second, at least until they got scared she might die. If they were scared you might die, why'd they try to get you to eat poison in the first place? The question scared her, the way that momentary feeling of pity had scared her. She wasn't used to questioning herself, and furthermore, the questioning voice in her mind didn't seem like her voice at all. "Wasn't meaning to kill me with that poison food. Just wanted to make me sick. Sit there and laugh while I puked and moaned, I expect." She waited 20 minutes, and then started down toward the beach, pulling herself with her hands and strong arms, weaving like a snake, eyes never leaving Eddie. She would have preferred to have waited another hour, even another half. It would be better to have the little muffer 10 miles asleep instead of 1 or 2. But waiting was a luxury she simply could not afford. That really bad man might come back any time. As she drew near the place where Eddie lay, he was still snoring, sounded like a buzz saw in a sawmill about to go tits up. She picked up a chunk of rock that was satisfyingly smooth on one side and satisfyingly jagged on the other. She closed her palm over the smooth side and continued her snake crawl to where he lay, the flat sheen of murder in her eyes. 4. What Detta planned to do was brutally simple. Smash Eddie with the jagged side of the rock until he was as dead as the rock itself. Then she'd take the gun and wait for Roland to come back. When his body sat up, she would give him a choice. Take her back to her world or refuse and be killed. "You gonna be quits with me either way, Toots," she would say. "And with your boyfriend, Dad, ain't nothing more you can do like you said you wanted to." If the gun the really bad man had given Eddie didn't work, it was possible. She'd never met a man she hated and feared as much as Roland, and she put no depth of slyness past him. She would do him just the same. She would do him with the rock or with her bare hands. He was sick and shy 2 fingers to boot. She could take him. But as she approached Eddie, a disquieting thought came to her. It was another question, and again it seemed to be another voice that asked it. "What if he knows? What if he knows what you did the second you kill Eddie?" "He ain't gonna know nothing. He'd be too busy getting his medicine, getting himself laid, too, for all I know." The alien voice did not respond, but the seed of doubt had been planted. She had heard them talking when they thought she was asleep. The really bad man needed to do something. She didn't know what it was. Had something to do with a tower, was all Daddy knew. Could be the really bad man thought this tower was full of gold or jewels or something like that. He said he needed her and Eddie and some other one to get there, and Daddy guessed maybe he did. Why else would these doors be here? If it was magic and she killed Eddie, he might know. If she killed his way to the tower, she thought she might be killing the only thing Gray Meat Muffo was living for. And if he knew he had nothing to live for, Muffo might do anything, because the Muffo wouldn't give a bug turd for nothing no more. The idea of what might happen if the really bad man came back like that made Detta shiver. But if she couldn't kill Eddie, what was she going to do? She could take the gun while Eddie was asleep, but when the really bad man came back, could she handle both of them? She just didn't know. Her eyes touched on the wheelchair, started to move away, then moved back again, fast. There was a deep pocket in the leather backrest. Poking out of this was a curl of the rope they'd used to tie her into the chair. Looking at it, she understood how she could do everything. Detta changed course and began to crawl toward the gunslinger's inert body. She meant to take what she needed from the knapsack he called his purse, then get the rope fast as she could. But for a moment she was held frozen by the door. Like Eddie, she interpreted what she was seeing in terms of the movies. Only this looked more like some TV crime show. The setting was a drugstore. She was seeing a druggist who looked scared silly, and Detta didn't blame him. There was a gun pointing straight into the druggist's face. The druggist was saying something, but his voice was distant, distorted, as if heard through sound baffles. She couldn't tell what it was. She couldn't see who was holding the gun, either, but then she didn't really need to see the stick-up man, did she? She knew who it was, sure. It was the really bad man. Might not look like him over there, might look like some tubby little sack of shit, might even look like a brother, but inside it be him, sure. Didn't take him long to find another gun, did it? I bet it never does. You get moving, Dada Walker. She opened Roland's purse, and the faint nostalgic aroma of tobacco, long hoarded but now long gone, drifted out. In one way it was very much like a lady's purse, filled with what looked like so much random rickrack at first glance. But a closer look showed you the traveling gear of a man prepared for almost any contingency. She had an idea the really bad man had been on the road to his tower a good long time. If that was so, just the amount of stuff still left in here, poor as some of it was cause for amazement. "You get moving, Dada Walker." She got what she needed and worked her silent, snake-like way back to the wheelchair. When she got there, she propped herself on one arm and pulled the rope out of the pocket like a fisherwoman reeling in line. She glanced over at Eddie every now and then just to make sure he was asleep. He never stirred until Dada threw the noose around his neck and pulled it taut. 5. He was dragged backward, at first thinking he was still asleep, and this was some horrible nightmare of being buried alive or perhaps smothered. Then he felt the pain of the noose sinking into his throat, felt warm spit running down his chin as he gagged. This was no dream. He clawed at the rope and tried for his feet. She yanked him hard with her strong arms. Eddie fell on his back with a thud. His face was turning purple. "Quit on it," Dada hissed from behind him. "I ain't gonna kill you if you quit on it, but if you don't, I'm gonna choke you dead." Eddie lowered his hands and tried to be still. The running slipknot Odetta had tossed over his neck loosened enough for him to draw a thin, burning breath. All you could say for it was that it was better than not breathing at all. When the panicked beating of his heart had slowed a little, he tried to look around. The noose immediately drew tight again.
"Never mind, you just go on and take in that ocean view, Gray Meat. That's all you want to be looking at right now."
He looked back at the ocean, and the knot loosened enough to allow him those miserly, burning breaths again. His left hand crept surreptitiously down to the waistband of his pants, but she saw the movement, and although he didn't know it, she was grinning. There was nothing there. She had taken the gun. "She crept up on you while you were asleep, Eddie." It was the gunslinger's voice, of course. "It doesn't do any good to say I told you so now, but I told you so. This is what romance gets you, a noose around your neck and a crazy woman with two guns somewhere behind you." "But if she was going to kill me, she already would have done it. She would have done it while I was asleep." "And what is it you think she's going to do, Eddie? Hand you an all-expenses-paid trip for two to Disney World?"